here now. I was in Onondaga for 30 years.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Basically in Onondaga, Syracuse guy.
Yeah. City Hall, then over to the county for a while.
That's what I remembered. I didn't know if that was where you were from or not.
I was born in Indiana, so I grew up in Indiana.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you went to Syracuse for a career?
Went to Maxwell, yeah.
Oh, you went to Maxwell School?
Yeah. Same idea as you. I was going to get into city manager.
I was very angry at MTA. When the Johnson money came in, it was simple. Cornell will give you a
certain
amount of money, but you got
to. If everyone's ready to go, we're going to begin this meeting. Call the meeting to order. First of all, let me just introduce the members of the task force. To my right, I have Liz Thomas, who is the supervisor for the town of Ulysses. I have the Honorable Betty Poole, who is the Enfield Town Justice. I have Jason Leifer, who is the supervisor for the town of Dryden and also an attorney in town. And I have the Honorable Glenn Galbraith, who is a retired professor at the law school, as well as the village justice for the village of Cuba Heights. And I'm Ray Schlauder, and I'm the chair of this group and also an attorney here in town. Expected later is the Honorable Scott Miller, who is the Ithaca City Court judge, and possibly Mark Solomon, but we're not sure about that. And excused is Gwen Wilkinson, the district attorney, as well. And Mr. Solomon has a standing excuse because of illness in his family, but we're not sure if he's going to make it or not. So that being said, tonight we have here what we're going to try to do. First of all, we're going to hear from Attorney Bill Shaw with respect to the genesis and perhaps demise, but hopefully not permanent, of the youth court in Tompkins County. We're also going to hear from Carol Booth and Susan Cowell, who are members of the board at the Tompkins County Mental Health Council. We'll get the full title later. They're going to speak about the possibility or the recommendations with respect to a mental health court. Those are the two presentations this evening. We will also make a brief presentation with respect to the results of the Nassau County Skyping session in terms of the district court presentation. And then finally, if we have time, we'll discuss our writing assignments as well as the next very important meeting, which is March 30th, where we will actually be in active discussion concerning our findings and some of the underlying issues. So that being said, do we have any additions or changes to the agenda? Seeing none, we'll proceed. We do allow for public comment briefly by any members of the public. Tonight, I don't think we have anybody who wishes to speak, but perhaps, is anybody here outside of the presenters who would wish to add to the public comment? There is none. So the chair's report, I don't want to delay the presentation by our panelists. You do have, I think, a very thorough and accurate set of notes that were prepared by Joe Mariana and reviewed by me with respect to the very useful discussion that we had with the Nassau County District Court officials on February 25th, 2016. And we can get into that later, but the report speaks for itself, and I would make that part of the record. Joe, any staff report?
Only that we did send out data on DWI arrests by town in 2013 and 2014. Hope everybody got that. And I think that's it.
Okay. By the way, I skipped the approval of the February 24th, 2016 minutes. May I have a motion with respect to those, please?
So moved.
Any changes, deletions, comments? None. Do we have a motion? Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. So moved by Judge Galbraith, seconded by Judge Poole. All those in favor, say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Seeing none, the minutes are accepted as drafted. And again, if anybody has any kind of typographical errors or anything of the sort, though I did review them, I don't see anything of significance that warrants change. But if anybody does, let us know. All right, fair enough. So tonight we have, and this is our, I think this is our 17th meeting. Yes, meeting 17. This is our 17th meeting of the task force. And we are pleased to have with us this evening a gentleman who, ironically, as we were researching youth court, we noticed, said, oh, we know this fellow. And that was, of course, Bill Shaw, when he was in his younger days. And he was very actively involved in the creation and development of youth court back in the 1960s, I believe. And so there was some notoriety at that time, but then more recently, he wrote an article that was published in the New York Bar Journal about the court, and frankly, that's how I stumbled upon his name and the whole concept. We've already heard, or we have received evidence with respect to other youth courts that are currently existing elsewhere in the state, but I thought it would be useful for us to hear from Mr. Shaw, and who, by the way, is also a... Are you still a town justice, or are you...
Retired.
Retired town justice, so he's got a good insight into all of this. So without further ado, Bill, I'd love to hear from you, and just so the record is clear, we're going to limit this discussion, this part of the meeting, till approximately 5:15. So let's hear from Bill, and we'll take questions, and we'll take it from there. Okay?
Thanks, Ray. Before I begin, I'd like to get a sense of audience in one regard. How many of you were here in Ithaca in 1960? About what I would guess. A lot of turnover in Ithaca. It's a different world, and yet, as I had the opportunity to reflect on what I would try to say in a few minutes, I was kind of surprised at some of the similarities, at least from a criminal justice standpoint. And as Ray alluded, I was a town justice for 4 years, town of Covert, by the way, just over the line. But also, I've been a practicing attorney for all of my adult life, studied at Cornell, got an MPA degree as well. And criminal justice, particularly juvenile justice, is a major part of who I am, where I came from, and why I jumped at the chance to come here instead of continue fishing off the end of my dock and boiling sap, which I'll do in an hour. The Atopkins County Youth Court came about as a very local event. Most of you are familiar with George Junior Republic. Its name has changed, but it has been here literally since the century before the last. And Daddy George is the precursor to the Tompkins County Youth Court. And the most important person would have been Malcolm Freeborn, who was the managing principal at George Junior Republic during the late 50s and the early 60s. And through his creation, creativeness, initiative, persistence, and extremely hard work, the youth court came to being in 1961-62. Now, he didn't do it alone, but he took the concept that we had right here in Freeville of youngsters, 13, 14, 15, 16, prosecuting folks, other youngsters who had violated some rule, defending those young folks, judging them, and being a jury. That happened right there in Freeville for a long time before the Tompkins County Youth Court came on to our public stage. And Malcolm Freeborn saw that, saw the opportunity, believed in it, and strived mightily for well over a decade to see it come to fruition. Well, he came to the community, and he then, and I strongly advocate this point, through youth, not top down. He went to schools, he solicited active youth advisory groups in the city of Ithaca, and we didn't have too many in the county at that point in time. And he brought together a group of youth to say, what do you think? Well, a lot of us thought this would be a great opportunity, a good idea. We certainly needed the guidance of folks like him, and a lot of names that the older folks might remember, Jackson Hall, among others, later Bob Kitaya, tremendous valuable resource through the City Youth Bureau, and many others, particularly local attorneys. You couldn't talk about the youth court without crediting Dick Thaler for his incredible efforts, first as a private attorney and later as a very young district attorney. This idea came about through, first of all, lots of meetings, just like these, only kids, high school kids, junior high school kids. They came up with the idea of a constitution.
They went around to all the schools in the county. They promoted this constitution. They took a vote on this constitution. Over 4,000 kids voted on the youth court constitution. It passed by an 81% margin. This was real democracy. We're talking kids here, average age about 15. That constitution set up the structure that I'll get to in a quick second for you. There's an advisory board, administrative board, I think it was called, made up of both youth and adults. And the youth court came into being first in 1961 when that constitution was discussed and voted on, and then it became, their official date would be 1962. So we're talking 54 years ago. There was no there was no book to go to. There were no materials to read. There was no experience. You couldn't go look at the district courts in Nassau. This idea was created out of the local folks and people like Malcolm Freeborn in that era. On the other hand, the basics were fairly straightforward and remarkably similar. We didn't use the exact phraseology, but alternatives to incarceration. We didn't know that phrase back in 61, but we were looking for alternative ways to deal with juvenile delinquency, to provide a juvenile justice system that might be not only fairer, perhaps, but also more effective, perhaps, also provide tremendous opportunities for the young people involved. I'm forever grateful for that opportunity I had, and many others. When you read these names, you think about folks who continue to contribute to our community. The concept, which I think I want to turn to with that background, was relatively simple. There are a lot of young boys and girls who violate a law or what have you, a rule, an ordinance, outside of the school district. Very important, this was not within a school. That was an adamant premise. This was going to be in the community. That need the process, need peers to talk to them, involve in their reassessment. What did you do? Why did you do it? Can you be persuaded that you made a mistake and how to cure that? So this peer review process came forward. And the process itself, I was chuckled, I found this is an antique. This is a simple, we've all seen diagram charts and so forth. But if you look at this today, Ray's been doing criminal justice almost as long as I have. It's the same process. There's an event. There's an arrest. If you're under a certain age, there's a petition and family court and probation gets involved. If you're 16 or over, then some court, village, city, town court gets involved and there's an arraignment. And then there's an attorney usually involved. And then there's a plea involved. And then there is a defense created if there is one. If not, there's plea bargaining if that's appropriate. And then there is either a plea or there is a trial. We all know how that proceeds. And then there's an outcome. And then there's either a conviction or a not guilty determination, maybe more than one charge. There might be alternative outcomes depending on the multiple charges. And then there is some sort of sentencing. The youth court basically said to the judges, who at that time, Betty, they were essential. The town judges made this go. But we also had to have the full imprimatur and support of the county judge, at that time Norman Stagg. You must have the support of the district attorney. And at that time, as I mentioned, it was Dick Thaler and briefly his predecessor. You had to have the support and approval of the probation department. Sadly, that was one of the areas that was inadequate and lacking over almost all the life of the youth court and in part contributed to its demise in 1984. But all of those different entities got on board, supported it, joined the kids, and we had kids trained. We went to 8 and 10 week courses. I was 13. Dick Thaler taught the course. We passed a bar exam so that we knew the basics of the adversary process, and then we became potential defense counsel, prosecutors. I did both of those. I then became a judge. I was then as a chief judge. And how ironic it is, Ray, I don't think you know this, our first court proceedings, this building.
Right here,
right downstairs. And we had arraignments. We had jury trials. We brought in other youngsters to serve as jurors. We had outcomes that were convictions. We had outcomes that were acquittals. We had sentences that would include community service, write a paper, talk about what you did, pay some sort of penance. I think in many respects, as I reviewed my writings on this, the sentences often were on the stricter end, but nothing beyond any normal spectrum that town judges are familiar with. The result was a little tricky to work out, but short version was if they were under 16, basically the recommendation went back to the probation department, who closed what they called an intake. There was that alternative, informal intake was the phrase that was used at that time, and basically the probation officer signed, close the case. If the referral came from a town judge, village judge, Judge Spry in Lansing referred the vast majority of those early cases, that judge would take this outcome and adopt it. Not compelled to, was never an instance where the judge didn't, and adopt it, which would mean a dismissal in that town or village court. There'd been an outcome that was sufficient to basically dismiss in the interest of justice. The proceedings included young men and women up through the age of 18. Got a little dicey at 18 because you had judges, prosecutors, and jurors who, for the most part, weren't 18. So you had a certain amount of slight inconsistency. But most of the times that we had an 18-year-old, they were still in high school, and the judges and jurors and prosecutors were fellow high school students. It was a peer adjudicatory process. That socialists, and I studied sociology a bit, would say, yeah, I'm not so sure. They were age peers, community peers, but were they actual peers in life? Perhaps, perhaps not. The answer, I think, was there was a fascinating mix of the background and interest of those of us who were in the youth court and those who appeared before us. So was there a social economic strata that would differentiate us? The answer would be, of course, but not perhaps as much as some critics suggested. The court struggled finding an administrative home. Eventually, we persuaded Bob Kutaya to help us with facilities through the City of Ithaca Youth Bureau, and we were down those who've been around for a while, remember the Tin Can, and we ran our programs down there. Later it moved up to GIAC. Ray remembers this. He was, I believe, president of the GIAC board back in the early 80s, and it was housed for a period of time in the GIAC facility over here on Albany Street. The funding came in part from the county, part from the city. The sad, bitter truth is it was a cheap program. There's no other word for it. It was nickels and dimes. We begged, borrowed, and didn't steal, begged and borrowed a little bit of space that was usually available in any public program, and we had a very modest budget. There would be a youth court coordinator. I and many others served in that. We were students at the time, college students, paid a pittance because of the work experience was valuable. The volunteers did almost all the rest. So the budget for this youth court was never, ever significant. But it needed every year to be reviewed and funded by some public agency. And sadly, shortly after my term as mayor of Ithaca, a very fine successor, Goody and I are good friends to this day, but he and GIAC felt there was stress financially. We'd had a financial crisis at the time that the city could no longer fund Tompkins County Youth Court. While I vehemently disagreed with that, I was not in a position, and I can at least understand that that was a difficult decision. So at that time, 1983, plus or minus a few months, it was not refunded under the city, the county did not pick it up, and it ended. I want to save room for questions, but I also want to point out that in 1964, we got inquiries from Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, Hamburg, New York, Newburgh, New York. Some of these I remember, the others I'd have to kid you and make up. But literally all of the state, all of the United States, I remember Germany, I very vividly remember Alaska. What are you guys doing? How do you do it? And we gave out all of this information so they then had a prototype to copy, and we were copied throughout the entire United States and several similar things in Europe. Now it's very thrilling, and it is terribly ironic and terribly sad that that the home of Tompkins County Youth Court, the first one in the world, no longer has one. And as Ray mentioned, there are many of these youth courts throughout the United States. You can get data and statistics on that. It's readily available through some federal agencies as well as private juvenile justice foundations. The youth court was never high volume. There were years when it had very few cases. It had to constantly go to the town justices, city court judges, district attorney. There was a process where it could be referred there. Probation was the weak link. Probation had a high volume, regular, informal intakes, that was the quoted phrase at the time, that were excellent candidates for referral to the Tompkins County Youth Court. We would have brought the peer review and adjudicatory process, but probation was hesitant. I knew those people well. I worked with them for decades. But there was just a hesitancy, the sense that somehow the professional training would be better. And those cases, the volume of those cases, did not come from probation. And keeping up with contacts with the town and village justice was just very time consuming. So there were times that it dwindled, times that it rallied back, and we had cases from as few as 5, 10, 15 a year to as many as 40 and 50 a year. And it varied over the years. It was not a youth jury. You will see there's a lot of literature out there, and there's a history of youth juries. It's a wonderful program. You could start that tomorrow. Betty Poole could assign a youth jury to advisor if she so chose tomorrow. I believe the law would support her in that clearly. But a youth jury is an advisory group. Young people sit in the town or village or city court, hear all of the information, get involved in various ways, but the judge retains the final decisions. I'm not here to advocate that, and I don't feel that that is anywhere near as valuable for your community, for our community. The recidivism rates were very hard to study. We didn't have the money or time. We struggled to do some recidivistic evaluations, drawing in sociologists from Cornell University in particular, some I remember. And the answers on that were mixed bag. It depended on how you read the data, how you collected the data, how you were able to follow up. As you know, a lot of these cases are sealed, so the recidivism is a very hard thing to monitor and evaluate when you're dealing with young people. So in quick summary, 12 to 18 was our age range. I was 13 years old when I was involved with youth court initially, 55 years ago. The judges typically were 16 or 17 and had first served as a prosecutor or a defense counsel. The kids that came before us, for the most part, were not 12 and 13. They had to sign a consent form. Parents had to sign off on that. They were free to withdraw at any time. It was voluntary, but they had the incentives that I've alluded to and can specify more as need be, including ultimately a dismissal if it was in a town or village course, or a conclusion if it was in the probation department. So it was well run, heavily youth involved. I can't stress that enough. Not top down, supported by the youth in the community, served a wonderful purpose, ended for a reason that had nothing to do, in my view, and I think others, Ray, can speak to this, nothing to do with the merits of the program. It just fell in the gaps between city and county. We didn't have a county youth board then, by the way. I was first chair of your county youth board after that. No, I take that back. I'm going to correct myself. I chaired the first county youth board in the late 70s, so we had a county youth board, but we didn't have any staff or no budget. It was just a bunch of us served on. I could go on, obviously, but I want to force myself to stop and respond to questions in any way I can about what we did and, more importantly, how it might be adopted or implemented today.
I think that would be great. Bill, thank you very, very much. Why don't we go either to my left or right, whoever wishes to ask a question first. Glenn, you have some?
I know the dollars are different nowadays, but how much did it cost in terms of how many salaries had to be paid on a full-time basis? And if you were to fashion such a court now, how do you think it should be funded?
First of all, we never had more than paid half-time staff. So whatever it would cost for mid or lower level administrative personnel, maybe an entry-level probation officer, just divide that in half, add the fringe benefits, you have a rough idea of the salary. Now, you might add a few bucks for clerical support. Every program has necessary clerical needs, so that would be maybe a quarter time. That should still be sufficient unless somehow it bloomed because of providing value, and then you'd be making a different assessment plan. You'd have the base say, this is working well, I'll put more into it. In my opinion, there's only one place that it should be housed, Tompkins County Probation Department. That's the perfect, logical, rational place. I have re-examined that view of mine for some 50 years, and nothing has changed my mind. It should not be tied with a town or village judge. It should not be tied with a district attorney's office. It should not realistically be tied with a county judge. The probation department does this kind of service. It's an alternative and would need to be persuaded, or maybe they would come forth with zeal and say, yes, we would like to have the opportunity to take this kid, this child, whatever, I don't mean child in the technical sense, this young person, and have them have this opportunity. I'll explain it. Their parents can sign off. It's voluntary, always voluntary. And the value is the peer adjudication. Recruiting the young people is a piece of cake. You absolutely have enthusiastic response for that, and a lot of volunteers. Same with the advisory board. The potential to serve on this board was enormous, and we had, as you would today, quality people willing to serve. That's the nature of our community, Glenn.
May I just follow up on that? Is that
sure.
So with respect to that, first of all, could you envision law enforcement making the referral directly as opposed to coming through the courts? My concern here is to try to figure out how to avoid records, meaning records on the careers and of a young person. So
Let me answer that question. First, with a preface, one of the things I left out, because I don't really have a structured set of notes here, but Connie Cook, who was our assemblywoman at the time, with my active involvement, submitted a bill to the New York State Assembly that passed 149-1 that authorized youth court as an alternative to probation, this intake. Now, unfortunately, Senator Hughes up in Onondaga County had some just hesitation, just classic conservative hesitation, so it didn't become law, but the concept was very easy. The answer to your question, Ray, is absolutely. I believe that police could refer that. First of all, if they're under 16, we have that going on now all the time where they refer it to probation department. If they're over 16, then I believe the answer would be you'd have to have an officer and probably a prosecution official say, yeah, we're going to agree with this alternative diversion is fundamentally what it is. And as you know, many of the officers would gladly recommend that. They often know these youngsters. They're members of the same town and community, and they know what they need is somebody else to criticize them rather than a uniform or a judge. And involving them before the youth court, we had many active, strong supporters among law enforcement. So I think the process, we can't do it here in a few minutes, could easily be defined, but fundamentally it would be equivalent to the various, how many different diversion programs do we have now? Quite a few.
Right, but many of the diversion programs start with an arrest. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm envisioning is something where a law enforcement officer, obviously we'd have to limit it to certain classes of offenses.
Sure.
I can't imagine doing this with violent crimes, but with certain classes of offenses, I could see law enforcement being given the discretion to simply, just as they do now, instead of arresting somebody, they drive them home or they call their parents or whatever. In this fashion, they could just have the discretion to call a probation or whatever the receiving entity is and say, I've got a case for you.
Well, first, you're right, roadside reduction, you all must have heard that. It happens all the time, so officers have and should have that kind of discretion. The actual legal process, you'd have to rely on that voluntary nature that I described. So the officer would have to speak with the parent and say, we have a program here that we think is appropriate for your child who committed this act. And rather than arrest him and file a petition with the town or village or city court, I'm willing to refer this to probation on an intake basis if you agree. That would be voluntary, but I do think that would fly easily.
I interrupted you, Glenn. Go ahead.
No, it was.
So what, may I just ask one other, as long as I've got the floor here. Can you see this working if the age were extended, say, all the way up to, say, age 21? Why not?
Lots of reasons. First of all, I don't think you're going to lose the community. Mr. Voss. 21, you don't have the people who live here, both the kids, the parents, and the other supporters. Secondly, I think the peer was the peer assessment was always strained, Ray. There was always legitimate criticism as to whether we had the good kids, quote unquote, dealing with the bad kids. Now, I always resented that, but that was a stereotype that we often heard. And I think you would amplify and add to that criticism if you started having young people who are 19, 20, college age, being brought before a group of what is the success, I believe, is at the high school age. I think it would be, I'm very active, as are you, in the various campus judicial. We're not here to discuss those. But I don't think that the peer process would work nearly as well.
And I'm wondering whether, for instance, so often our young people are growing up more, in some sense more quickly, but in another sense more slowly, historically. And so I'm wondering whether TC3 could be more actively involved in this, along, frankly, with the Ithaca College and the Cornell campus. But saying so,
Well, certainly TC3, particularly, it has a criminal justice program, and it'd be a source of volunteers and students and faculty that could be helpful. But in terms of your basic question, do I think that this would be successful as the defendants start to be turning beyond 18 and 19? No, I really don't think the peer quality would be of value. And let me rephrase that. At the core, that's the reason to have it, is to hope that you will instill some sort of peer review and not criticism, empathy, but understandance, guidance, role modeling. I could go on, it's a sociological analysis, but that coming before and looking at a judge who's your age, your classmate, we've got three great judges in this room, but they can't do that. We are the father and the grandfather of these kids. We're not going to have the same impact as when, by the way, it was a panel of three judges. There are a lot of details I left out. So there was a chief judge and two others. So that defendant and their adversary, I'm sorry, their advisor, the lawyer, was a kid. The prosecutor was a kid. The clerk, the bailiff, the jurors, they were in a room full of kids. And that process, no matter how you defined it, had a dramatic effect that you can't replicate the minute you have the court systems that we're all in all the time now.
So I do want to turn this over to some of the others, but I have other questions. But Jason, do you have any questions?
You said that the court ended around 1984?
1984, yes.
Probation or something?
No, it was simple. The city, who was paying the staff salaries, I mentioned the halftime staff, was dealing with financial stress at GIAC. That's where it was housed. So GIAC had a budget, needed more money. The mayor, John Gutenberger, said, we don't have that much money. We just went through a recession. We've got to keep it. And where are you going to cut? So there was an advisory board. Ray was on it. He was also an alderman at the time. I cast no stones about that, but the reality was Tompkins County Youth Court wasn't going to compete with GIAC and Ithaca neighborhood programs. My reference to probation was at that point in time, I was still in the community, very active in the community, and I had said, as I had said for decades, go over and persuade the folks at the probation department to bring this program in to house it. That wasn't received. It wasn't rejected, but it wasn't accepted.
Any other questions, Liz? Judge Poole?
I've said this already, but about how many kids would go through that system a year? I mean,
in the neighborhood, Liz, of as few as 10 and as many as 50 and 60. It could have handled more.
Do we have any clue, like, where we stand now, what the numbers are now across the county?
I mean, of young people in this
right.
age group?
Oh, about.
No, well, in terms of, being sent through the system in some fashion.
Oh, probation would have an answer for that.
Might be able to get that.
You want that?
At least up through 16.
Well, we might even be able to get it beyond 16 because a lot of the YO stuff may go through there. But it may require some
This would be
guessing.
A relatively small fraction. I would think at best it would be 10, 15, 20%, because so many, as those of us who know are in the juvenile justice system, the defendants have multiple problems. And so you're immediately going to have to rule out a bunch of them where the peer issue is going to be compounded. And, as Ray mentioned, some of them very serious crimes. Youth court isn't going to handle assault. We actually did handle a few, but as a day-in, day-out matter, it's going to deal with petty larceny, malicious mischief, criminal mischief. I could go on, but at that level. UPM, certainly it could deal with it could deal with seventh-degree possession, which is a misdemeanor. UPM marijuana is even a violation. Underage drinking, you could deal with a lot of those.
Betty?
I'm done. I was just going to ask, Ray alluded to the fact that certainly the types of crimes would be limited. Given the types of crimes that you saw back in the 60s, comparatively speaking to the types of crimes this age group might be involved in today, do you feel that this could be really successful?
Well, the easy answer is absolutely. The nature of the crimes arguably has gotten more serious, that kids do a lot more nasty stuff and the consequences and the crimes, but there's still a vast array of good kids doing stupid things. And whether it's vandalism, spray painting, UPM being a classic example, experimenting, making mistakes, hanging with the wrong crowd, this goes on, it'll never stop. It has to do with the age. And pushing the elements and being perhaps a little less supervised than we might wish and all the rest of that. But even the supervised ones, same thing. Steal a mom and dad's car, the neighbor car, joyriding, all of those things. They're not going to stop. And they don't necessarily require, in my very firm belief, the formalities of a town, village, city court process. This would be an alternative with the benefits that I've described and very low risk. There's going to be... a period of time, these things don't happen quickly. This youth court process would take 2, 3, 4 months. So if they repeat it and so forth, they probably would no longer be eligible for youth court.
When you talk about certain kinds of offenses, would you consider, for instance, peer fighting, would you consider that to be a covered offense or an offense that should be excluded?
No, I think it could be covered.
That would be covered.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
So an assault case, if there's two kids fighting...
Yeah, assault covers both. If you've got a gang assault, I would say no. But if you've got two kids fighting, that's going to always happen. It always did happen. And we covered those. We handled those. In fact, I can... it's a little vague. 55 years, a long time ago. I pretty much remember some apologies and maybe they were both... I'm a little vague on it, but I can remember some creative solutions to say, what are we going to do to have you guys work it out? Because you're going to be back in that same classroom together. Tomorrow, we didn't have orders of protection in youth court, and often that would be just the opposite of what was necessary, how to work it out and bury the hatchet.
If sure. I may, just one more question. What did you do if an individual went through youth court and everything was fine, and a month, 2 months, 3 months down the road came back before you again? Are you still going to leave that decision up to an officer as to whether or not to refer it?
If I understand your question, Betty, we had
recidivism.
We had repeat offenders. They were few, because certainly you had to say, whoa, did it fail? On the other hand, it's really hard to remember, and I was in youth court for a long period of time, but there were periods of time where I was absent. I seem to remember a repeat offender, petty larceny, and it was referred back. I think it was Judge Spry. I think it was from Pyramid Mall. It's funny how these things come back to you. And he referred a kid a second time, and we dealt with it. We dealt with it more seriously and more conscientiously. On the other hand, I think if you had an assault case and fighting and it came back, I think the referral authority, that's one of the terms we use, would say, no, we tried that. We don't know if it worked or not, but we're not going to try it again. We're going to do something incremental.
All right. I think that's...
good to see you.
Oh.
If you have a question?
We are recording, Judge Ellis.
We are.
Very good. I apologize that my city court duties prevented me from getting here to hear most of your... Oh, I'm sorry.
would like just the record to reflect, though, with the addition of Judge Miller, we actually have four competent judges here today. Judge Chernish is also behind us, and as well as yourself as a retired judge, so makes it five, I guess. All right, anybody else, any other questions at this point? Bill, thank you very, very much. This is, it's not only informative, but it's inspiring, and we appreciate your comments and your preparation. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, and if there's anything at all that I could do as a volunteer, if you decide to go forward, that's a standing offer. I'd be glad to do whatever I can. This is a lifetime commitment by me.
Fair enough. Good. Our next panel is Carol Booth and Susan Cowell. Crowell, forgive me. I'm sorry. And Susan and Carol are here, and there are some handouts that they have provided. They're here to discuss the question of New York State mental health courts as perhaps something that might be of interest and could be implemented in this county. And I will allow them. I've known Carol for many years, and has been very active in the community, along with her husband Dick Booth. And these folks are good, valuable people, and I think they have something important to say. So we'd love to hear what you have to say. And again, Carol, we run until shortly, right at roughly 6 o'clock. But if whatever it takes, we want to make sure we have a full airing. So please. All right. We do have a microphone, and we're going to ask that everybody speak into the microphone because we require.
Can you hear me?
For posterity.
Can you hear me? Okay. Well, thank you for that introduction. I've been a mental health advocate for over the last 20 years and a disabilities advocate my whole adult life. I'm very interested in this particular alternative to incarceration. Mental health or behavioral health courts beginning here in the city of Ithaca or the county. I'm a member of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Finger Lakes, as well as the state and the national, and I've been a long-term member of the Tompkins County Community Services Board and the Developmental Disabilities Subcommittee and a retired special ed teacher from Racker Centers. And that's all I'll say about me. I just want you to know that I've been involved in all of this, and I'm pretty passionate about it. So I guess what happened, Susan and I have been interested in this idea of mental health court. And just about a year ago, I co-facilitate a mental health family forum, actually, and many different kinds of people come, not just family members, community members, service providers come. And every month, at the end of the month, we have different speakers. And Rich Shaw, who does this with me, he works at the Mental Health Services Department. He and I decided that it would be good to try to get someone to come to speak about mental health court. And I first went to Judge Rowley. I contacted him. I was told to do that. And he seemed to be very interested, but he suggested going to the two city judges, Judge Miller and Judge Wallace. So they came the end of March, and we had a pretty packed house. And I would say, and I think you would agree, that there was a lot of interest and lots of discussion. And it was just an initial way to get some people in the community for talking about this. Over the summer, Susan and I went up to Auburn, to the Auburn City courts, and they're in their seventh year of, they have a drug court also for a long time, but they've had a mental health or behavioral health court for over 7 years. It's been very successful. They were very open to our coming and meeting with, sitting in on the session, but also meeting with the treatment team ahead of time, which is what happens before each session. Each individual who's coming before the judge that day, all the various people like probation, employment, substance abuse, mental health, housing, et cetera, talk about the individuals to prepare for the session, and they were very open for our being part of that also. I think we learned quite a lot. So Then we went to the drug court here. We were told to go and visit the city drug court, which we did in December, and we learned a little bit more. So when I heard that we could kind of put this idea into the mix, I mean, there isn't a court right now for mental health. There is none presently, but we're hoping that maybe we could move in that direction. So that's why we're here. About a year ago, the Urban Institute of New York City actually wrote a report, and an article was written in the Atlantic Monthly in April 2015 stating that 50% or more of individuals in jails and prisons are struggling also with serious mental illnesses. Our local jail manager, who also came to one of these meetings that we have, forums, he came several months ago, Captain Ray Bunce. He believed it to be as high as 60% at times, and he is struggling to give services that are desperately needed. I'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. In terms of that Atlantic Monthly article, they stated that 50% or more, 55% are males and 73% females struggling with mental illnesses. And of course, many of these people have substance abuse and some may have developmental disabilities also. Depression is about 21%, bipolar 12%, schizophrenia 5%, post-traumatic stress disorder 7%, anxiety 8%, personality disorder 6%. Now, there is little or no treatment available here in Tompkins County Jail, but that's not unusual. There's not treatment available in other counties throughout the state or throughout the country. Many of these individuals, as I said before, have co-occurring disorders. The jails are overcrowded with individuals who are ill and they need treatment, not incarceration. More beds could be released to others who need to be in jail if we had a mental health court. So, what is a mental health court? I'm going to refer to the handout I gave you because it's well stated. It's from put out by the Cayuga County Bar Association about the Auburn Court. And I'm just going to read a few parts of that. And then I can tell you a little bit more about what I learned at the actually observing the court, and I think Susan can also. As a participant in the Auburn program, a participant would be required to follow the instruction given in court by the judge and comply with treatment plan developed by the counselor or case manager. The Auburn Court is a special part of the Auburn City Court. It's a court-supervised treatment program for people who face criminal charges and who also suffer from a persistent mental health condition, which is likely to have contributed to his or her involvement in the criminal justice system. Mental health court is voluntary and includes regular court appearances before the mental health court judge, and that's Judge McKeon. I don't know if you know him, Judge Miller, but very nice man. We thought. If you are accepted for a while, yes, and he's been doing this the whole 7 years. If you're accepted into the program, you will be expected to follow the treatment plan. I mean, this is what it's all about. And rather than incarceration, you're getting treatment. You're hopefully going to get, do better in your life. A treatment plan would begin with a comprehensive evaluation, a psychiatric evaluation, by a local mental health facility, Tompkins County Mental Health Services, Family and Children's. If there's a drug or alcohol problem, then that would be addressed also at that time. Now, the treatment plan could involve any or all of these: individual, group mental health counseling, day treatment, inpatient treatment, residential, medication management, substance abuse treatment, case management, educational, vocational training, appropriate housing, helping with benefits, helping with other life skills such as anger management, family counseling. So there's quite a bit involved. Following arraignment, a participant may be offered the choice of participating in the Auburn court or remaining in criminal court for prosecution on pending charges. If someone chooses to participate, he will be required to plead guilty prior to entering the program and sentenced upon receipt of a pre-sentence investigation. I'll just read a couple of other things. Successful completion and graduation from the Auburn Mental Health Court program may allow the participant to have his or her sentence converted in accordance with the contract. And of course, there are rules, like you have to show up for all the sessions and all your appointments and fill out the paperwork, etc. And just to add to that, because I had talked quite a bit to the individuals besides Judge McKeon, Carol Colvin is the resource social worker. She's a wonderful person. She's also been in the program for a long time. And so I got some information in terms of how would you go about proceeding forward with an idea like this. And so these are kind of general notes, and Judge Miller, you can correct me later but I'm just putting down what I remember from having talked to her. Permission must first be gained from the district administrative judge, who would be Judge Mulvey, but he's left to go on to something else, and I don't know who it is.
We don't know who.
Okay, but that's the position. Okay, that person would say yay or nay. Okay, if it's yes, there's a woman in New York City, Carol Fisher, who is the director of mental health courts in New York State, and she would actually come to Ithaca and help develop a committee, which would then apply for grants, etc. And I'm going to mention where that money comes from, apply for grants to set up this court. The committee that would be formed, like this task force, is to get it off the ground, to get everything taken care of. That could include people like city court judge, assistant DA, defense attorney, police, mental health director, mental health provider, could be from a clinic or housing or employment, alcohol and drug person, peer member, and a family member. So those are that's the way you would go about doing it, and those are some of the people that would be part of a committee. So I guess what I wanted to mention is that the funds for such, the grants that are written for this, come from the Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance. They administer all mental health courts, and grants are applied for, and the main individuals involved in those courts, as I've already mentioned some of it, the judges, the prosecutors, defense attorneys, case managers, and all the treatment team. So the Bureau of Justice Assistance is the one that has to be contacted regarding funds. Susan, would you like to say anything regarding our experiences up at the Auburn court, because we...
Well, I guess from an anthropological perspective, I was looking at the people who appeared before the court, and I was very impressed with the staff, but I was very impressed with them too. And I was kind of amazed at how much they got out of the court. And there seemed to be really good outcomes. And I also realized, which I've realized before in other situations, being involved with CASA in the past, things like that, that the judge had to be a very special person and had to be willing to listen to their stories and still make a judgment if he had to, as far as consequences. So it, in a way, it reminded me of how good justice can be in these situations.
I was also impressed by the judge, and also Carol Colvin, who's the resource case manager, because not only does a participant need to be in compliance with, you know, certain medical parts of the treatment plan, but, you know, they have families, they have jobs, you know, they have they're people, you know. We're supposed to be people-centered. I'm not sure we are always here in Tompkins County, but we need to be people-centered. And he would always, you know, he'd look holistically at each person, and they seemed to really enjoy engaging with him, I felt.
Well,
they're in court, but...
I tell my story about Chris, mm-hmm. I'll say that sometimes criminal justice is the only doorway. Like it or not, it is. And I think with the people that come before the judge in that instance, lot of times they don't have, they want the structure and they don't have any other resource.
So, I'm sorry, would you like us to interject if we have questions?
You
or
can
you
interject,
have more?
Or I have a few more things that
please,
I want to
go
over, and then you can interject as much as you want.
Fair enough.
I do want to talk about Chris.
Okay, and she's got a story, actually, but we'll move right along. So I guess we've had a drug court, city drug court, for how long, Judge Miller? I'm going to ask him now.
It started in 98.
Been a while.
18 years.
Yes, it's been a while.
It might be off by about 6 months, but about 1998.
Yes. There are many similarities here, I mean, in terms of how these courts, they're called specialty courts. There are veterans courts, there are domestic violence courts, there are mental health courts. In fact, there are over 300 in the United States, and they're growing. Both drug court and mental health court, both people who are seen in drug court and people who are seen in mental health court often have each other's disorders or addictions or, you know, illnesses. So there's a lot of co-occurring disorders seen in both. And we know that both drug addiction and certainly serious mental illness, they're medical illnesses, they're brain disorders. So that's certainly in common. Both courts involve treatment to try to help people get back on track rather than incarceration, although incarceration could be an end result with total non-compliance, of course. But in both courts, I think even though sort of behavioral modification techniques are used, there's a much greater focus on incentives. I mean, no one wants to send anyone back to jail. And so I did give you another handout, sort of a comparison of drug courts and mental health courts, and I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I'm just going to mention a couple of things that are different with mental health court. Mental health court, the charges can include a wider array of charges rather than drug or alcohol related crimes only. For mental health court, most common criterion is serious and persistent mental illness, which includes many different disorders, many of which I mentioned when I first started, when I opened. Expectations in mental health court, primary goal is psychiatric stability, recognizing even in recovery that for mental illnesses there are no cures. There's long-term support, case management are really needed. And in terms of monitoring, we can't use, well, for drug, for the, you know, substance abuse, we certainly could use urinalysis and other tests like that in mental health court. But in terms of just monitoring whether they're treating, you have to really be engaged with the treatment team, and there has to be close monitoring because there aren't those kind of tests for mental illness. And you have to be ready to adjust the plans and apply sanctions if needed. In fact, it was interesting, when we sat in that treatment team meeting beforehand, there was one person that just was having so much trouble and just wasn't going to be in compliance, and they didn't know what to do, and I think they had this thought that they were going to send her to jail overnight. But when she got in front of the judge after quite a bit of talking back and forth about, you know, her life and what was happening, a quick decision was made, no, that wasn't necessary, and they were going to move forward on what they were planning to do. So that was very, very interesting. So, it, you know, being ready to adjust plans and just relying heavily on incentives. So you can read the rest of that. I just want to say a little bit about our local jail, because we did 2 months ago have Captain Ray Bunce come, and it was very interesting. We had quite a few people that night also. Our local jail has been overcrowded for years. If individuals with serious mental illnesses could be diverted to mental health court, or there would be many more beds available to inmates who need to be there and save the county from having to board out or deal with individuals who need much more care than they are able to give. There is only one forensic social worker who devotes at most 6 hours to the jail, and one psychiatrist who would go up there, who goes if needed. That is not at all what they need. We found out the night he came to talk that Cortland County for many years has had a full-time forensic social worker in the jail.
I mean, not just to help those with mental illnesses, but also for the staff in terms of how to regularly deal with different incidents that happen. So I cannot believe that we have this little help. Captain Bunce is desperate for help at the jail, absolutely desperate. And there's no one public agency that can help. I mean, criminal justice must help, mental health services must help, but it must happen. So I guess I'll just say at the end here that the overall goal of the Auburn Mental Health County City Court is to decrease frequency of client contact with the criminal justice system by providing courts with resources to improve social functioning, leading to employment, housing, treatment, and support. The Bureau of Justice Assistance funds many of these resources, and as I said before, there are over 300 mental health courts in the United States, and they work very well for certain people. And certainly our recommendation would be for the city court judges to pick up the ball. And there are plenty of people out here that would be very interested in helping with this. We feel so strongly. I mean, it is terribly shameful that people who already struggle with such severe illnesses go to jail for misdemeanors or nonviolent felonies, when in most cases it's because of their untreated mental illness that they've done these crimes. So we have to do something about it. And we are behind the ball here in Tompkins County on some things like this. And I would love to see mental health court come here.
And thank you very much, Carol.
Okay, yes. Ms. Cronin, I'm not going to tell you the story of Chris, although I will just say that he left a huge impact on me because he was due to go in court. He'd waited 8 months, and the day of he was due to go in court, and he had some rough times. Sweetest guy you ever want to meet. He shot himself in his parents' yard. That was a pretty selfish act on one hand. On the other hand, this was a guy who had a good character, and I asked, where did we fail him? But his only door, in my belief, was the criminal justice system. So, you know, his family never would have gone into a mental health department. Never would have done that. And that isn't uncommon.
This is an experience here in Tompkins County?
Yes.
Thank you.
So I also wanted to thank the task force for the work they're doing. I think it's great. And I think along with the concept of consolidation, reconfiguring, or looking at as is happening across the country, and justice in a different way. And as far as mental health courts, there's some really exciting demonstration projects going on, and cost efficiencies are certainly part of that. I mean, in terms of figuring it out, there's some states that don't have much money, and they're determined to keep their mental health courts going. I've given you a handout. It's a pretty neutral handout. It gives the pros and cons and, you know, what's happening right now. So hopefully you'll find it useful. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Susan, thank you very, very much. We have a lot of questions, so why don't we, at least I do, but I'm willing that others go first.
And if we don't know the answers, we'll find them.
You'll get them for us.
Because we're not really, like, experts. We just...
Who would like to... I always put Judge Galbraith on the spot first, but do you want to...
I'd be happy.
Go ahead.
Yep. I have about five or six, but I'm going to ask one that sort of may deal with a lot of my questions. Is there any particular reason why we couldn't have a drug court / mental health court? Because a lot of the sorts of services, monitoring, checking in, the process could be very similar, and just simply, and we'd avoid a lot of extra bureaucracy of a separate court system and having to decide, does this person go to mental health court versus drug court? Why not together and have that facility that everybody in the county could use? Because if I have a case like that in Cayuga Heights, if it's a drug court eligible kind of case, I can refer it down to the city. Mm-hmm. Although, interestingly enough, I haven't had one for years and years, and I'm not quite sure why that is. But
it seems if we just expanded the services in our drug court slash mental health court, we might be able to absorb a somewhat different population and deal with the very problems that you're asking about.
You can't, you can, and you can't.
Tell us about that, because that's interesting to me.
Because in terms of a mental health court, you must have the team.
Well, there is a team in drug court, though.
Okay, and yes, it is done. I think Monroe County would be a good example of what you're asking. So you can, as long as they're separate also. You can't have the same people coming before a judge for drug. You're going to have to set aside different time, a different time for mental health cases.
Explain why it would be necessary. I'm not sure that's a problem per se, but why would you need to do that?
Well, because there are a lot of... There's a difference in the fact that people with mental health problems, and by the way, also I'd say that substance abuse, mental health problems, and developmental disabilities, and there's a high ratio of people that have developmental disabilities, have very different problems, which is why they have the highest recidivism rates of any group. They're not... The expectation of a cure resides more with substance abuse. You can't ask that in mental health cases. You just can't. So it's a whole different way of dealing with the problem.
Be that as it may, I'm assuming you have a judge and a team that recognizes the very differences you're identifying and would be able to adjust on a case-by-case basis in the same way they adjust between two different drug court defendants as well, who have very different needs and problems.
Well, I think there's a way of doing it to make it more effective, but there also has to be a separation somewhere. They are different. And, you know, I think that in the literature that if you look at it, you'll see that people have addressed that too, with different configurations.
I think in Auburn they have had a drug court for quite a long time, and now they've had a mental health court for over 7 years and felt that they needed a separate court. I don't know if it could be done. I know for years, well, I don't know how long ago, but I would mention, you know, say to people, I wish we could think about having a mental health court here. Oh, well, drug court really takes care of that. You know, that's not good enough for individuals with very, very complicated, serious, persistent mental illnesses of all types. I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but I think I would say it would be best to do it separately.
Well, and I don't even think we can entirely answer that question. And that's why you're here in terms of being a task force.
Right, just to think about that, yeah.
And, hopefully there's some good resources to look at that question.
Could I follow up on that? Do you say that Monroe County does have a combined court?
One judge, which brings me to what I consider one of the biggest challenges, a judge that really cares and is committed. And she is presiding over... I believe it was Monroe County, both the drug court, the veterans court, and the mental health court.
But as a combined, or she did it separately?
No, she takes it separately.
I think Judge McKeon in Auburn also resides over the drug court, but they're separate.
But are you familiar, I noticed in the printout there are a number of courts in New York State. Are any of these combined, or are they all with separate?
Well, that's a good question. I've been looking across the country, and... looking at the different court systems, and we'll continue to, but most of those are in New York City, and I haven't really looked at New York City, not because I have an upstate bias or anything. But
one other, and this may be more of an observation, but on that same point, drug court seems to succeed in part because folks who have alcohol or drug problems frequently need their peers, both encouragement and the example that is made of those who fail. They almost need that as a carrot and stick and what have you to go forward. So it's a much more community enterprise. Does that community enterprise work in a mental health court setting?
No. I mean, when we observe the drug court, for instance, what struck me was that one person that clearly did have a mental illness, his relationship with the judge was different. There wasn't that community that I saw with the other people in the court.
And then, I agree totally with that, and I just want to say that when, because we were at drug court together, and there really was a community of people, kind of, you know, there were some graduations, and so people were all together, and they seemed to know each other, except for this one person. But at the mental health court, it isn't like that at all. Individuals come in, they may have, you know, their defense attorney with them or their family member or something, and they're all kind of sitting separately. There's definitely not that sort of familiarity.
That was my next question. Are they actually given privacy when they meet with the judge and discuss their mental health problem, or is it all done in public?
No, it's all done in public.
Okay. I'm sorry. I interrupted. Go ahead.
That was really my primary focus, and that's helpful.
So there's more to learn about that.
Yeah, obviously, yes.
Yeah.
Let's go down, because I know others have. Liz, do you have a question?
Well, I'm just wondering, so it's the team that determines what the mental illness is, or how is that determined?
No, the first step in all of this is a very comprehensive psychiatric evaluation as to what the mental illness needs are. And then, you know, with individuals with mental illness, there are many, besides treatment, you know, could be counseling and medications or other similar things, but there's so many other supports that are needed, housing and jobs and benefits and, you know, all kinds of things. So the team takes, once the evaluation happens, and then they kind of, I'm sure they meet and kind of assess the person initially, because I believe there are three phases. The mental health court generally goes from 18 to 24 months, and then hopefully there's like a graduation. But I'm sure that the team gets together, and the various people on the team, you know, have input, and some of them have more input depending on what the needs of the person are. So, but it's there's an initial psychiatric evaluation that's done by psychiatric people.
Okay.
Doctors.
It seems like the requirements, you know, they have to take their drugs, they have to show, or their medications, they have to show up, and it's pretty strict. And mm-hmm. So if you have mental illness, sometimes, I mean, I know that some of the people that I've known have been very resistant to to that. Mm-hmm. So their alternative, if they don't do that, is that they do.
Well, this is a voluntary program. I mean, if they want to participate in this because maybe they have enough insight to realize, because many people with serious mental illness do not know they're ill. They don't. Right. They lack insight.
Right.
But the fact is, if they're able to see that this is a chance, this structured plan with lots of support, a case manager, all these people to help, a judge who really seems to care about them, I think, you know, given lots of incentives, I think it works for many people. Now, if it doesn't work, jail is the outcome.
Well, you know, and that's a question that comes up a lot in a lot of courts, because does that really do any good? So it's a question to ask. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those questions to be punitive.
Thank you.
Just to throw one other quick thing in here, mental health courts is one well-known alternative to incarceration for seriously ill people. AOT, which is assisted outpatient treatment, is a second one. It does involve court, but not criminal behavior, and it's not voluntary. So those are the two that are really diversions for people who really need help. They really need treatment, and these are two ways to get it. They're very different ways. One, you commit some kind of crime, and the other one, you're just so needy that you've got enough people saying, we need to do something here, period. Yeah.
Jason, go ahead.
So does the mental health court, I guess, have its clients, or are they people who have pled to whatever crime it is, you know, not responsible by mental disease, by reason of mental disease or defect, Criminal Procedure Law 220-15, or are these folks who haven't done that?
It depends on the state. It really varies.
I think with the people we saw, there was, at arraignment, you know, they have this choice whether they want to participate in the program, and then they do need to plead guilty to the whatever they've done. But that's converted at the end, hopefully, if they're graduated. But yeah, there may be a lot of differences.
Are they pleading guilty to the what you do in drug court? You plead guilty to the charge, and then later it would be
yes.
Because the procedure under 220.15 is different, where you need the consent of the DA, but then there's an evaluation after. There's an evaluation process. I dealt with a case with someone who then was sent to Rochester for a 90-day.
Yes. Forensic evaluation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is that what happens with the clients in the mental health courts? Or are they evaluated in the way a drug court team evaluates somebody for
admission? How does a drug court team evaluate somebody? I'm not.
Well, we have here in the felony drug court, there's a KSAT certified
person at
coordinator.
The court. Yeah.
And then these folks sometimes have already been treated at either one of the treatment programs locally, so you have other outside evidence, but. Typically, it's an interview through the probation department, the drug court coordinator, and then there's a recommendation made to the team, and then the judge decides whether or not they'll
it could
be admitted
be
into the program.
And some would have a clinician, you know.
Yeah, some may have their own physicians involved.
Which I think is a nice way to go. But, there's also something I'd like to bring up because it's like the elephant in the room, and it's a problem. Not just with substance abuse as well, which is a problem across the country, and that is great. You know, there's a diversion court, but what if the resources aren't there in the community? And why it makes it another form of justice, because somehow criminal justice has to work with the broader community, you know, that's just a reality. I mean, it could be exciting, but, you know, it's a problem.
But does, you mentioned the federal justice program, do they provide operational, or is it just to set it up?
I think there are ongoing grants, but there are grants, I didn't write that down, but for technical assistance and getting things started, the resources for paying, the social worker, caseworker who works with the judge, and technical assistance to get things started, and then I believe that there are more grants to continue. I don't know all of where the money comes, but I know a lot of it comes through that.
Do you have any sense of what it costs to set up one of these programs?
No, I don't.
No, but I'll know.
You know?
Not now, but I'll know later as I go through the different
She's
courts.
A big researcher, so we'll send that to her.
All right.
No, I think that...
If you could share that with us, it would be great.
I would be happy to. I think that the reason I've got Nevada in there is because they're so poor and their problems are so big, and yet they keep it going, and I'm really curious to know how they're dealing with mm-hmm. costs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jason, forgive me, I interrupted.
Oh, no, I think...
Scott, Judge Miller?
Do you have any sense... Judge Wallace might have a couple thousand criminal cases come in front of us in a year. Probably each of us have 2,000 criminal cases come in front of us. Low level, all the way. And in the last 2 years, Drug Treatment Court, the numbers were quite down. There were about a dozen participants. Judge Wallace and I have, with our joint referral system between my side of the court and his side of the court, we have participation up to about 40, which is really good.
How many?
40.
40, yes. I think you said when you came to visit that you were trying to revitalize or
so that's
just...
That's what we've been working on in the last year. We also had to set up another court called a DWI specialty court. We set that up in the last year.
Oh, really?
Let's keep... So there's...
just sort of giving birth.
I'm interested in this. We have no staffing for the courts that we set up already, but that's okay. About 50% of our drug treatment court participants are dual diagnosis. They have severe mental health issues, at least 50%. I would say about 20 out of the 40. And they are mandated through their probation officer that works with them to go to their mental mm-hmm. health counseling. Mm-hmm. So that's not mental health court.
that's just a component of drug treatment court.
Right, okay.
Do you have any sense, because Judge Wallace might have a sense of, in the city, how many purely mental health issue defendants there are that aren't dual diagnosis, that don't have substance abuse issues, because they'd have to go to drug treatment court if they have substance abuse.
Many, many people with serious mental illnesses do have substance abuse. It's a very high, alcohol.
But they're in drug treatment court.
You're right.
My question, do you have a sense of, in the city, and in all of our towns and villages in the county, how many individuals are getting arrested that are pure mental
just
health
like
issues?
Shoplifting and other things that
done,
may not be.
Well, wouldn't it? So I have a sense of a number in city court of when I see a repeat defendant and it becomes obvious they have mental health issues, that usually they're quite forthcoming. So I have a sense of what the numbers are in the city. I don't have a sense of what they are in the town of Ithaca and in Lansing and in Dryden. So
have a sense of in the city? What are the numbers in the city then?
That are actually getting arrested?
Yes, with simply serious mental illness as opposed to any kind of substance abuse.
Someone that we'd have to see them more than once because we wouldn't know.
Right, right.
If it's a first-time offender and they have a mental health issue, they're not going to get diverted to a specialty court because it's a first-time offense.
You don't know.
So it's the repeat mental health issue first that it becomes obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, actively, that are sort of coming in front of us, 5. Doesn't justify a court for 5, but if there's 5 in the town of Ithaca, if there's
right,
five
if
in
there
Lansing,
are more,
we might be
that's
talking
a good
about
question, something to look up.
100 people that are regular defendants that are pure mental health issue, mental health court possible candidates. So, do we have any sense of that?
No.
That would just be probably anecdotal.
We don't have it because that's hard data to get.
And so I guess my other question is I know some of these defendants that, you know, there's 2 that I can think of regularly. Now some have such mental health issues and are so interwoven with the criminal justice system, and their charges are so serious, this diversion wouldn't be appropriate.
Right.
They've got 20 years of mental health issues plus serious crimes. But there's other people, 2 that I can think of that are persistent, low-level, homeless, mental health issues. There's 2 that I can think of in Ithaca City Court right now. Occasionally, in the winter, they get sent up to jail. Do these courts, these mental health courts, do they work with their county jail? And you said there's a social worker at one of these county jails that is trained to identify this person as a mental health?
There is a person.
Needs to be treatment.
This person has spent 6 hours at the jail every week. She's a forensic social worker for mental health services.
The county jail is going to get all our defendants from the county at some point. So it seemed there has to be some central way to identify people that need this resource.
Well, that's a critical question to ask.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that, you know, we all go on these statistics, which can range greatly. I feel safe in saying that 25 to 35% of the people that are in jails and prisons now have a mental illness and don't belong there. That's a pretty safe range. But what you're asking is really important. I mean, it's an important question. And I think that that's something that a task force would address.
Are you following the creation of possible creation of that re-entry?
Yes,
I am. In fact, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. It confuses me why it's so focused on re-entry when the underlying problem covers pre-release, post-release.
Are you familiar with the re-entry order?
I
read the report.
It seems like this is a good fit.
It is a good fit.
Yes.
If it's expanded to include
this, that person should be trained to identify this person is in need of, this is a person in need of mental health.
We don't need to reinvent the wheel. That report's already been done. So
let me just
reentry. The reentry coordinator, though, is is taking the person who's already incarcerated.
Right, I know.
And what we're trying to do is figure out ways to divert.
But that person's going to get arrested again, and at least they can be identified of, okay, this person was sentenced to 30 days or 60 days. This person clearly, if they get arrested for similar things, is a has serious mental health issues. This is an ideal candidate to not go back to jail. So
well, reentry, if you only take reentry and you take it out of context, I'm a systems thinker. And it does, you know, I read the report, I appreciate the work that was done, but it doesn't make sense to be, to not look at the spectrum, to look at the continuum. And that way, then we start to get good data. We don't have any right now, but we could.
That person is going to be an employee of the county, is going to be up there for meeting with people about to get out of jail, but certainly they could be going up to the county jail with people that have just gone to jail and maybe bail. They're going to be there anyway. They'd be trained in all of these areas, I hope, as well. So this is very helpful. Each point
along the continuum experiences the same problem in terms of resources.
I'm going to interject. Thank you, Judge. Judge Poole, do you have some questions?
Let me preface it by saying you indicated that Captain Bunce said approximately 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How, in the interim, between the time that they enter mental health court and the conclusion of their case, a lot, I've found, because I have a couple too, Judge Miller, that come to mind right off the bat. They need to be monitored in the interim. And I couldn't agree with you more. Our mental health is abysmal. Assistance is abysmal. We have none. And these people need help. Mm-hmm. So my question is this Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance, is that strictly for mental health courts or, and you probably don't know, but I think we're in desperate need of facilities to be able to facilitate these people as well.
Well, the state does have money too, and I think
that BJA is in charge of all mental health courts. Mental health courts. They probably do some other things too, but I mean, they are in charge of all the mental health courts in the country.
I think what Judge Poole is asking is, do they also expand to include, say, residential facilities so people can have a place to live, housing?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know that the state has some money, and I wish I could tell you more.
I mean that could be part of a treatment plan, that somebody would go to a residential treatment inpatient for a while as part of their treatment plan, but that would be more of a state or local situation.
Right. Okay, but the grant money you're talking about is more for setting up the court
and keeping
perhaps
it
operationally
going. Exactly.
The court.
Exactly.
Okay. I have a few questions. I did want to. I know we're running over, but I just would like to ask: have you, in connection with all of these other courts in New York, have you visited any of the other mental health courts?
No, we haven't.
And do you have the statistics, or if we look in this yellow sheet, Susan, that you prepared, would that give us the data that we might have with respect to some of these other courts or not?
In terms of the state courts?
Just curious, you know, in other words, I have a map here with a whole bunch of stars.
But it won't. But I have them. So
if you wanted
me to send them somehow to somewhere.
I think it would be useful to get some of the data to find out saturation, mm-hmm. how these programs mm-hmm. operate. I'm very curious about, I mean, maybe you know, in Auburn, how frequent do they go to court? Is it
they
once a week?
They go to court twice a month.
Twice a month?
Every other Thursday.
I'd love to know about, you know, the sizes of some of these other courts and whether they measure recidivism and how successful they are, and et cetera. The other piece that I'm interested in is the question of this whole end result legally, because what troubles me a little bit is that, you know, the ticket, at least in Auburn, is you have to plead guilty to the charge. And you're really opening yourself up to some pretty serious repercussions.
That's a criticism that people have had.
Okay. And so that's the way it works there. I'd be curious to know whether some of the other courts have different different models.
Other courts do.
And if
I don't know about New York.
If you're able to get us some other material, I'd love to read about that, and that would be helpful. And then, and apropos that, if they do succeed, do they then end up with perhaps a clean record as opposed to just avoiding jail? I mean, in other words, it strikes me that the whole idea is that many times people get into a jam because they have an illness, not because they're diehard criminals.
That is right. And, well, I think that that's the thing in terms of the figures with substance abuse, even the people that are going before the court, you know, there's the whole issue of being very vulnerable because you already have a mental illness, which might not be immediately apparent, and the fact that people self-medicate.
I think the flip side of that, though, is, I'd kind of like to know what some of the entry or the threshold crimes are that they're allowed to do. I mean, for instance, I think there are people with mental illness who commit sexual offenses. I'm not sure that, you know, for instance, pedophiles are a classic example.
Would that be a violent crime?
Well, that's my question.
Because misdemeanors and nonviolent crimes.
That Auburn is dealing with. I believe maybe New York City had the first, I think Brooklyn had the first mental health court.
They may be dealing with somewhat higher level crimes at this point.
Okay,
but so Auburn, it's misdemeanors and nonviolent.
Misdemeanors,
yeah,
nonviolent.
Definitely there's a line there.
And that also ranges across the country in terms of whether they take serious offenders or, you know.
But now would nonviolent, I mean, that can be tweaked, but I'm assuming if there's a person who's being arrested and because he's in a psychotic state, he ends up becoming violent and the police officer charges with resisting arrest, that presumably would not disqualify that person.
Right.
I don't know. All right. I think if I get all that data, I'll have a better handle on that. Does anybody else have other questions here? Judge Turner?
From the Peanut Gallery, I was a board member of what was then the Special Children's Center 20 years ago. And I'm a doctor, but I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And I've got a case right now which I think illustrates a lot of things that are wrong. And it kind of points to the silos that we have in this county. a subject who has pled guilty to a misdemeanor. It was reduced to trespassing. And the pre-sentence investigation said he needed a mental evaluation. And I don't think that we needed a pre-sentence investigation to determine that. He made himself very difficult to find. And even though he was a patient in our county mental health services, and finally I had to get him arrested in order to have this evaluation. And as a result of that arrest, he spent 30 days in the jail. 30 days in the jail. Because the psychiatrist who evaluated him said he needed to have further evaluation. And along the way, I had to threaten a certain manager in the county with contempt of court. And I'm not going to say it wasn't you, of course. And I don't mean to sound like a guy with a funny hairdo when I say that. But 30 days in jail. And when I said, well, how can we speed this up? The answer was, well, the sheriff has to find the guy a bed. And I thought, you know, this is really kind of unusual that the sheriff has to find a psychiatric bed for a person who has been found to be sick. Not the psychiatrist or not the mental health people. But that's the way that works. So after 30 days, he is now in treatment, and he is about to finish up his evaluation period, and I'm faced with the decision of following the law or doing what's right. I mean, I could follow the law and say, okay, we can dismiss the charge. And then he is on his own again. But then on the other hand, we have the silos. We have the mental health people, we have the community service people, we have the housing people, we have all these other folks. And what we really need is a manager. Now, I don't know. I sound like maybe a mental health court would be that manager, but I don't know that we need to go that far. Why can't we have a manager to handle these things? So that's my conundrum.
Well, maybe.
And I'm the guy who, you know, is that one who got into it and said, let's see what we can do to help this person. That's my nickel for it.
One of the suggestions that's been made, or a theme, is that maybe a mental health court should have the jurisdiction over mandating that agencies provide the services they need to provide. I mean, it's something.
I think that's part of it. I think.
Well, no, I don't think the Auburn court has that authority, do they?
Well, my guess is there's a resource issue, too, though, but yeah.
All right. There is some accountability there to the people providing, particularly with the outpatient, assisted outpatient treatment. There is definitely accountability on both sides, and they do need to provide treatment. So it isn't quite that way with the Auburn court, I guess. I just have one final thing, and then I'm done. This thing came up about, well, do we need, you know, two courts, because we know that, you know, people in mental health court have substance abuse and the other. I think what I saw in Auburn is, yes, almost everyone who came up before the judge there at the mental health court, they had some substance abuse problems. But I think it's what rises to the top when something is so severe that mental health court is where you go, as opposed to, you know, maybe your drug addiction, maybe you have some mental illness, depending, maybe you end up in drug court. I absolutely see a place for both, but I think your questions about how can we find some people out in the outlying areas who are not getting what they need, and can we pull all those people in? But Judge McKeon is a good person to talk to, Judge Miller. He's been doing it for 7 years, and he's been doing both of them. So he would have some good answers to that. I thank you so much for having us come, because we don't have a formal proposal, but we really believe in Tompkins County showing some progressive attitudes toward mental illness, which doesn't always happen. So we want the best for individuals and families.
Thank you. Thank you, Carol and Susan. That was very, very helpful and informative. And I look forward to any additional information you can provide to us. Just email it and email it directly to Joe, and you have his email address. I've sent emails to you folks.
Actually, I was going to ask you, rather than taking up the time now, I've been up since 3:30 this morning, and would there be any way that you could email me the
questions you had, not the questions, the additional information that might be
whatever information you want.
Yeah, when the minutes are put together, we'll identify those, and we'll make sure a formal document is sent to you. Okay.
Good. Thank you for hearing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right. We are a little bit running late, so we will not worry about the status of writing assignments. I would note, though, that I did receive a draft from Liz of methodology, and I'll get back to her and we'll discuss that. Our next meeting is going to be probably one of the most important the most important meetings that we are going to be having here, because we're shifting gears now. We're going to go into discussion. We're going to try to address some of the questions that are in the agenda, as well as any other questions that we feel are important. So you've got them there. What are our findings? Have we identified problems? If so, is there a way to minimize or avoid them? And if so, how would we implement those? And that kind of a discussion. It's going to be substantive discussion. So I would encourage everyone to please read and revisit some of the material and the minutes and whatever other material you have, so that we can kind of go into this with an eye towards, at this meeting, try to identify some of the areas where we think we can make some changes or recommendations, and then how we're going to go about that. So, that being said, have we added value today? We'll start, Liz.
Yeah, always educational.
And the next meeting is March
30th. March 30th, right. It's March 30th. That seemed to be the date when everybody could actually be here, given their calendars. And
Is it 4:30,
right? 4:30.
Okay, I wrote in my book at 4.
No.
Maybe I did that on purpose. 4:30 p.m. No, and I would echo the sentiment. I think this has been very valuable, very useful, and I appreciate all the effort that people have put into this. All right, we are adjourned.